there. This is Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. It's a podcast about making things up and making things happen. I love talking to creative people. And today's episode is a little bit different. It's a group of people talking, and it's inspired by an episode I did a month and a half or so ago, an interview I did with the author Tim Murphy, who wrote a wonderful book called Speech Team. Speech Team is about a group of middle-aged people who were all part of the same high school speech team in the 80s, and they come back together after one of their group takes his own life and leaves a message on Facebook, kind of a suicide note, and mentions that the supervisor of the speech team, the teacher in charge of it, said something really effed up to this guy that haunted him his whole life. And the surviving members of the speech team realize that they all have something that that teacher said to them or did to them that has scarred them. And so they come back together and try to confront the guy down in Sarasota, Florida. So that's the premise of the book. And it got me thinking back to a specific time in my life, not my speech team days. My supervisor then was Sarah Smithson, the teacher in charge of the speech team, the best, really formative, really inspired me, one of my best teachers ever. But the time I was thinking of actually happened a bit later. It was after I went to college and I didn't know what I was going to do. I auditioned for this musical theater workshop that was happening in Los Angeles because some of the other people that I knew from ASU were doing that. And I was like, I guess I'll try it. And I wanted to be a performer. I was into that world for sure. And I got in along with some other people from Arizona State. So it ended up being, I think, 22 people total, 11 guys, 11 girls is my memory of it. It was 1986, the fall of 86. And this workshop was 12 weeks, 5 nights a week, like 6 hours a night. It was very intensive. There was scene study. There was audition night. There was, you know, dancing, everything. You know, it was like a boot camp for this. And the guy that ran it was a guy named Paul Gleason, who was kind of a controversial figure. He was one of those people that sort of would give you tough love and tell you, you know, you were too fat or whatever. And there was like this audition night that was kind of brutal. It was a mixed bag of stuff. Like I got a lot out of it, but I look back and I was like, that was a little fucked up. So in 2017, six of the 22 of us got together for a little mini reunion. And we reminisced about this. And I, at a certain point, pretty early on, I was like, hey, do you mind if I record this conversation for my podcast? So this was 6 years ago. I recorded it on my iPhone and then I couldn't find it. And I was like, and so I never played it. I never used it. And then after reading Speech Team, I thought, I'm going to see if I can find that file because I think it resonates with this idea. I got through it kind of okay. But as you'll hear in this conversation, other people had different memories. So I want to tell you who the other people are in this episode. My friend Dennis Osborne, who is a writer now and also working on a podcast project and has written a book. Like, he's brilliant. We met doing that workshop and then had many years when we didn't see each other and then reconnected about 10 or 12 years ago, and he's become a really good friend, and I'm so glad that he's in my life. Carol Foreman is also at the mini reunion. She has actually been on the podcast before. She was one of the stars of the musical Shooting Star, about a musical about porn created by Florian Klein, and Carol did this very podcast a few years ago. Of all of us that did the workshop, I feel like she stuck with the performing thing and had the most success, and you'll see her in shows all over the place. She did Lady Day, the Billie Holiday musical, and I got to see her in that. She's amazing. She was on an episode of The Conners not long ago. She works all the time, and she's amazing. John Thomas is also on the podcast. He left performing, and he now works in software and has worked in London and is in a totally different field, but is still as funny as ever. Kristen Dahl, whose house we were at in California, she had a very long career as a dancer and choreographer, both in New York and also in lots of touring productions. She transitioned into nonprofit work, and now she lives in Texas with her husband of 26 years, and she works as the chief of staff for this company called Lyft Aircraft. And so I went on their website. It's like drones for people. It's like you don't need a pilot's license. You fly these like little, they have like, I don't know, 10 propellers or something, and you're in it and you fly around. And she's the chief of staff for this company. They've been on Good Morning America and Anderson Cooper. Google Lyft Aircraft and it'll blow your mind. And that's what Kristen's doing now. And Sherry Fleming is also on the podcast. She went into theater education and she teaches performing, and she also writes and directs musicals for young people. So she stayed in that world, but she got out of it as a performer, and you're going to hear why when we have this conversation. But before we get to that whole little reunion, I want to remind you that this podcast, Dennis Anyone, is brought to you by me. I do it because I love it. But there are ways you can support the podcast. You can go to DennisAnyone.net and leave a tip in my virtual tip jar. I really appreciate that. A number of you left tips after my dog Enzo had his medical emergency. He's doing much better now. Thank you very much. So I really appreciate that. That's DennisAnyone.net. Helps me cover my expenses. Also, I would love it if you considered becoming a subscriber to DNR Studios. I'm part of a group of shows under the Derek and Romaine banner, really fun LGBTQ shows. And for a monthly fee, you get my show early and all these other great shows. And if you say that my show is the show that brought you to the platform, I get a little financial kickback. So there's that. You can learn about that at dnrstudios.com. Also, if you like the podcast, I would love it if you rated it on whatever podcast app you listen to. It helps people find it. It helps it move up in the algorithm. I really appreciate that stuff. All right, that's enough of the plugs. Here now is my reunion with my friends from the Musical Theater Workshop, Dennis, Carol, John, Kristen, and Sherry. Okay, I'm here in Kristen's lovely backyard in Moore Park.
Yes.
With there's six of us that were in this Musical Theater Workshop together. Carol, say
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
John.
Hello.
Kristen.
Hello.
Sherry.
Hello.
And Dennis.
Why, hello.
And what was, remind me of exactly, I love that. What exactly was it called? The American Center for Musical Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Music Theater.
Where
Music
most
theater.
People knew Music it theater as workshop. The LA Civic Light Opera Musical Theater Workshop.
Okay, so it was 5 nights a week.
I never knew it was that.
Right.
Yeah?
I never knew that.
I didn't know that.
It's new to me.
I have no memory of what it was called.
It was 5 nights a week. Mm. 12 weeks, 6 hours a night. So it was very intense.
Mm-hmm. They owned you.
They owned you. But it was one of those, like, one of those experiences in terms of learning and education where you felt like they were being really tough on you and you were going to learn these lessons like that Debbie Allen. You got big dreams and you're going to suffer and I'm going to, you know, there's a lot of mindfuckery going on. And do you guys think of it that same way or do you think of it as a little like, I don't know, just like there were... They were doing some kind of voodoo with us as performers.
It was living in another dimension for 13 weeks.
A totally other dimension.
Just totally, you're not in your life, you're just there.
Wow.
It was like boot camp.
It was like boot camp, right?
Yes. Everything you, every, your daily life was really not yours.
I do remember, like, Tuesday night you would audition like it was a regular audition, and they would go, I don't like that sweater, why did you, like, they would go in, right? I remember the main guy, Paul Gleason, told me I had to lose 15 pounds or something, and he was right then, and he's right now. But what did people, did you get,
same
did you
15 ever, pounds?
The exact same, no, did you, do you remember any specific criticisms or compliments that you got?
I don't remember offhand, I can't think of one of mine, but I do remember him saying to one of the girls, he's like, your hair is horrible, and just totally criticizing her hair. I think it was, I don't remember who that was. With another girl, he said, so what kind of car do you think you are?
What kind of car do you think you
remember that? There was car and dogs,
yes.
Right?
And she's like, he had, like basically had her down to, she's a Nova.
Oh my God. Novas were the cards they would give away on Prices Right when they didn't want to get a really nice car.
That literally means no go. You're
and
a no go.
And would explode.
So you were assuming that your audition wasn't going well when he called you a Nova.
A Nova. Wow.
Yes.
I remember he's called my acting, I'm a little teapot, short and stout. He said, this is. Look at me.
He made you sing Sex Pot.
Me.
He made you change it to I'm a Little Sex Pot. I remember
that. I don't remember that. I have no memory.
I think we have a lawsuit on our hands now with that.
But I remember I was so mad at him. I'm like, I'm going to show this mouth. I'm going to kick his
ass. But even years later, and I moved into writing and stuff. I wasn't really into, I'm not going to be musical. I wanted to show him a little bit. I didn't think about it all the time. But when I did think about it, I was like, I kind of want to show him that I did all right or whatever. I don't know. There was something about that.
It was difficult to sing more than 16 bars of a song after that workshop because all we ever got to sing was 16 bars. Right?
You know, it's interesting when you say you wanted to show him. For me, it was, I was constantly hearing, as John has mentioned, that you know, we were, he took a risk on us. Yeah. We were the youngest.
You guys were really young.
We were so young.
I mean, I was 21, but you were like 3 years younger than.
Yeah, we were barely 18. And he said he took a risk on us. He took a risk on us. And I remember then when I entered into my career thinking I wanted to prove him right. I wanted him to be right about
me. You wanted him to be proud of you.
I didn't believe I was worth the risk. Mm. And so I just wanted to, I wanted him to be right.
I was the same way.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the weird thing about it, there was no risk having you there.
No.
I mean, that's what I mean.
Voice of reality, ladies and gentlemen.
The things he used to say to people to make them, to put them
to
off.
To manipulate you.
He found your buttons. Right. He was good at finding people.
There's no point in that.
Well, he
certainly had his eye on mine.
They also made it seem like there were thousands of people clamoring outside to have our spots.
Yes.
When I think they were kind of like literally going down, do you want to be in this workshop or whatever? Like, yeah.
And then they finally get in and say, now I'm taking a big risk on you.
That's right.
I didn't realize before I did it that every song in the history of musical theater was about getting laid.
Well, they all are.
Yeah.
Because
that was what we were told to do with every single song.
That's right.
He wants to F her brains out.
That's right.
Sing like
he would want, what do you want? He wants to F her brains out. That's what he wants. She wants to F his brains out. That's what she wants.
Like, how does that work with how do you solve a problem like Maria?
She wants to have her brains out. That's what she wants.
You know what? You know he solved that problem
exactly.
Shit out of her.
That's why. And that's why that song was never sung in the world.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
But it was sort of that thing of like,
thank you.
The business is slippery, and you have to have angles, and you have to work it. It's kind of a game. Like that was something I took away from that.
But that's because that's how he saw it.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And it's not like
I don't think it's like that always.
It's
I think it can
that's
be.
What he saw, and he was projecting all of his crap onto. Everybody coming into his empire.
I think he was the last of that generation of people who would bust your balls or, you know, those people who would pick at you because they knew there was a lot of rejection in this business.
They wanted to toughen you up.
My mother would say it's like, you know, you have to have thick skin to survive this business. So I think he came from this mentality. He would try to find your weakness. He would go in and just niggle at it to see if he could get a reaction out of you, or how you would respond or come back. Would you withdraw and wither away, or would you lean into it? And I think he was trying to get most of us to lean in and challenge ourselves. That's how
I thought there's just better ways to do it than humiliating. And,
I agree, too, because I saw how it devastated some people, and some people never wanted to perform again, and I think that's a shame.
Talented people.
Very talented people.
That don't need that lesson.
No.
You know,
no.
I mean, it's bad enough to get rejected at auditions. Mm-hmm. You're going to be fine. Everybody else is. But to suffer some of the humiliation that everybody went through.
Yeah, and we're paying for that.
Yeah.
It was probably, you know. But I understand where that came from. I also know there's no talent kind of is irrelevant. It will keep you working once you've gotten in. You need to be talented, but it's not necessarily always a prerequisite because sometimes people maybe learn after the fact because it is a craft, it is a skill, it is something you have to continuously work on and develop.
Well, but that's what I thought the workshop was about, was working on the talent and developing the talent, not getting humiliated every week and told you about your hair and your sweater and you know. I thought it was going to be training for musical theater.
I agree. That's what I thought.
And what it did for me, though, it trained me really well. One thing that I took away from it that it trained me really well for was the audition process and being able to walk away from the audition knowing that I had put my best self forward. I was a salesperson in that moment. I'm selling myself. And they may not be buying what I have to sell that day. And I remember that from an audition where I walked in and I sang one of our audition workshops. And I walked in and I sang maybe, you know, two bars. And they stopped me. And then in review, I remember Gary Davis said, that's my ex-wife's favorite song. And I didn't feel like hearing it. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's so completely out of your control most of the time.
Yeah.
How do I know? I could be the right look. I could be I could be wearing the right thing. I could have the right song. I think the right song prepared. And it's his ex-wife's favorite song. So he doesn't want to hear it. So I don't get the job.
Mm. But the thing is, that's what I'm saying. I worked in casting. No casting director is ever going to cut somebody because they don't like it, because their ex-wife didn't like the song.
Right. Right. And I agree with that, but it also did help me
so
to...
So unprofessional for a casting director to do something.
But it does sort of say that there's a lot of things you can't control.
That's true.
Yeah, I think that's a good lesson.
Detach yourself as much as you can personally from the casting decisions. Mm-hmm. That if you are not chosen for a role, that it's not speaking to your character, it's not speaking to your heart, it's not speaking to your life, it's that you weren't right for the role. And it may be that you didn't have the chops, it may be that you're not,
right.
You know, you didn't have the skill that they were looking for, but...
You just might be too short.
So might have sung the wrong song.
I came off of 2 years of through high school, I was with a group called the Young Americans.
Mm-hmm. The Young Americans,
yes,
we love the Young
Americans.
Yeah.
Right? Yes.
So I had been in the Young Americans, and I had a horrible career in the Young Americans, right? I had messed up one show, and then... I could never do well in the group after that. But coming over to ACMT, it was a completely different perspective. Like, the Young Americans were still... That Young American up with people mentality, mm-hmm. That's who we were.
Too. Yeah.
Right? I mean, and that's all we did is everything was happy and, you know, like you were talking about touring, we would show up and we would unpack the stuff and we'd do our show and they'd make money off of us and then we'd go to the next one, right? And everything was just, we felt like we were living in this fantasy world of musical theater. Mm-hmm. And Paul's Workshop was the first one I got in where I was like, oh, this is a business.
Business, yeah.
Yes. It was a big reality sandwich.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think, too, I mean, he was, and they, at the time, were still probably trying to figure out what it was. But when I think about it, he was probably the only person thinking of branding at the time because he would give us assignments that were close to roles that he think we might play.
Right.
And sure enough, I mean, I went on to do some of those roles mm-hmm. that I was given in that workshop. So I felt like, oh, okay, I have this sense of it.
You were so good with cabaret. You're so good.
Oh, thanks. Well, I ended up doing Sally Bowles years ago and discovered I was the first black woman to ever do that role, you know, in a show. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I mean, there's something to that, but I had a point and I can't remember what it was.
Brand.
Helping your brand.
Brand, yeah, but I mean, before we called it branding at the time, but I also think what I was going to say, in a lot of universities and you know, these conservatory programs always teach us to be sacrosanct about the art and the creative process. No one ever talks about the business.
Right.
And that's what I got the most out of. I mean, those audition workshops, you know, walking in, you know, knowing how to walk into a room and presenting. Because, you know, I thought, it was the first time I thought, oh, it's a job interview. You know, this is what I'm going in for. It's not like, do you like me? Do you like me? It's like, this is my skill set. This is what I have to offer. I either work with you or I don't. So after a while, I realized, and I think that's what saved me from a lot of beating myself up, was like I just didn't match with what they had.
Right.
And I think that's is what helped put my mind in the right direction, because I see so many talented people and listen to them beat themselves up and play these mind games with themselves, never mind Paul Gleason doing a mind F on you, but what we do
you can say it.
A mind fuck on
you.
But what we do to ourselves. So it's like, okay, well, maybe he was externalizing a lot of that trash that we say to ourselves.
But the workshop was very much about working and finding a way in the business and stuff like that.
And I
really
appreciated
just like
it.
The whole 16 bars. Like, I felt like most of it was about auditioning. Mm.
I don't look back on that and think that I learned sort of craft of performing. I don't think of like, oh, this is where I learned to break down a scene. Yeah.
Right.
Or this is where I learned... I don't have any memories of that kind of work.
Because I don't think it was about that.
Taught me to sing, though.
Individual.
Like, singing.
I was a cute guy with a pretty voice, and then Carlos taught me to sing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that, throughout my life, changed everything about what I did.
You got lucky. I never learned how to sing. Because I never considered myself a singer, but I knew that if I wanted to work in theater... Because I left home with $50 in my suitcase, and I dropped out of college with a full ride at this very expensive private university to come do this training program. So
Holy shit, I had no idea, Carol. Did we know that?
No,
my mom and
I
had this huge fight. She says, if you go, you don't get any support from us.
You came out for Paul Gleason's thing.
I drove up because it was my first time working around professional actors. I was doing the show called Little Shop. I was non-equity at the time with all these people, and this woman, Lita Gaithers, who had worked with Paul, said, I want to warn you about him. He's crazy, but he will teach you what you need to know.
Right.
She said, he's an asshole, but listen to him. And I was like, okay, okay. Mm-hmm. And she just said, I'm just warning you now. Watch out for Paul. So when I walked into the audition and I met Paul and I was like, he says, I'm Paul. I'm like, oh, my friend Lita warned me about you. And so he laughed.
He loved you.
And he did. And then he offered me a spot right there. I was under the impression that it started the next year, and he said, okay, we start in 2 weeks, and I was like, I was still in college.
I was entering my second year of a four-year program that was like a full ride to a very expensive university. So I went home because I was miserable there. I was a dance major, and they didn't have any more acting scholarships because I was an actress. I was like, Mom, I really want to do this professional training program because I want to be a working actor. And my mom was like, hell no. You know, my dad, you know, Dad and I can't afford to send you to college. This is the only money you get. This is your only chance. You're going to stay in school. And I was like, no, I'm going to go up and do this program. She's like, well, you don't get any help from us. Don't call us. So I had $50 in my
bank. How much courage did that take?
That was amazing. I was just stupid.
Do you regret it?
And then I stayed with Robert. No, not a day, because I got my equity card after that. We did Rhythm of Life.
Yes.
And the casting director.
Yeah, it wasn't stupid at all.
Yeah, the casting director was there for the show called Little Shop of Horrors, which I had just done in San Diego.
You did the Sammy Davis Jr. part on Rhythm of Life, didn't you?
Yeah. And
so
she
good.
Said, they're auditioning for these urchins. Come down. And I went, and Glenn Casal, and they saw me, and they offered me the job. And
so you got a professional job out of that workshop?
Right out of it.
Wow.
So that was like...
Right. That's really cool.
That was it.
When we were saying, who came to that workshop? Who came to that?
I was like, who was in the audience?
I got a gig out of it, but it was really small. I worked for the Minnesota Opera Company for about a year.
That's awesome.
Right? And they would fly me back. I was doing this really weird avant-garde opera by Morton Subotnick, and they'd fly me back, and I'd stay in Minneapolis for like a month at a time.
Yeah.
And then I'd come back, and I never, like, that was it. But I got that out. I got that out of the workshop.
Yeah.
Okay. How did doing the workshop change your life? Like, what did it do that really reverberated into your future? I'll go first.
Yeah. Please.
It got me out of Arizona, because I didn't know what I was going to do after college.
Which is a blessing.
Yeah, I just didn't know.
Arizona's
like,
beautiful.
I had, like, big dreams and things I wanted to do, but I didn't know how to drive in a big city. I really was not, like, I needed some other kind of safety net thing to do to move. And some other people at ASU had done this program, and so I just kind of was like, I'll audition too. And I got in, and so I came out with people that I knew, and got me out of Arizona. And I think the biggest thing for me was Annette Cardona, a.k.a. Cha-Cha Di Gregorio in Greece.
I'm loving that.
Came in, like, what, once a week and did dance classes
and acting.
Mm-hmm. And I remember staying with her class, you know, in the months after the workshop and keeping it going. And, like, 8 or 9 months later, I auditioned for Princess Cruises. Mm. And because I think I had stayed in Annette's class, I got the job. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would have been good enough without that. And that really changed my life, because I did that for 5 years, and I went around the world, and it sort of was the thing. But that's what I take away from it more than probably any, like, I don't know, I didn't do traditional musicals in town and stuff like that. But, yeah.
Wow.
Well, Kristen's got a success story.
Yeah, Kristen, how did it change your life?
So I went to New York very shortly after ACMT, and I ended up dancing in New York for probably 10 years. Wow. I did lots of national tours and regional theater in New York, and gosh, I think it gave me the confidence. I was a small town girl and a big deal in a small pond. And then I went to ACMT, and there were other people who believed in me. Mm. And, you know, hearing someone say to me, we chose you because we thought, well, she's going to work, you know. And so I would reflect well upon them. Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of an affirmation to the
voices. They gave you like a stamp as if we believe in this girl.
And I believed in myself. I mean, we've talked about that around this table, that I was just, you know, I was young and stupid and didn't know right. You know, I didn't know what was this.
We were raw, young.
I was just so raw, and I didn't know not to say to someone, you should give me that job. Oh, you're casting a show? You should give me that job.
I hope that during the podcast you've got her head shot up for this.
Because that headshot is pretty splendid for us.
Well,
I will post the headshot on the page.
Actually, her headshot is his logo for it.
The hair alone. The 80s hair alone.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
It's a little bit Glow, if you've been watching Glow.
Love you for
so,
that.
So, you know, it served me well in my career, but it also served me well in transitioning out of my career. Mm-hmm. When I left theater, I realized I did have a lot of business skills.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that what I had learned, certainly framing theater as a business, which ACMT did, framing it in that way, putting it in that context, helped me to stay, I think, somewhat sane when I was in the business and then transitioning out of it. helped me to realize I could apply those skills elsewhere and that I wasn't entering into the marketplace, the traditional marketplace, with no skills.
Yeah. Right.
You know, that I really did have a lot of skills.
When you went to New York as a dancer, was it like the dream that you always thought it would be, like working dancer in Broadway? Like,
yes and no.
For a while,
yes
was
no.
it like
for
that?
A while, for a while, it absolutely was.
You're like, but I'm doing it. I'm dancing on
I
this
did
coin.
It.
Did you have to dance on a coin in 42nd Street?
I did. I carried the coin. You carry it like so.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. And you had this certain way that you slammed it.
When I was on the cruise ship, we had coins.
Okay.
But the ship's moving. So the coins are not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
And I was like, this fucking coin.
Yeah. So I was on solid ground.
You were on solid ground. Yeah. But yeah, it was fun to dance.
Fun?
People loved when we danced on the coins. The so coins. They must have loved when you guys did
it. They did love when we danced as soon as we came out with those coins. Maybe what they liked better was actually when the curtain raised and all you saw were the feet. Though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
a big
amazing.
Moment in that show. It's a big moment in that show. So, I mean, I have no regrets. I look back on my theater career and I think I did. I lived my dream. And then when the dream was tarnished, I left it. You know? And so I have no regrets. I am someone who can say I've never woken up in the morning and thought, ugh, I have to go to work. I haven't had a day in my life that's like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What did you do after you left? Like, what field did you go into, or what?
So I actually went. I taught for a while, like Sherry. I began a performing arts program at a private Christian school.
Nice.
And yeah, it was really
That's
great.
Awesome.
And you know, John's talked about like the dream is to, you know, if you win the lottery, you can teach a high school theater, and really to invest in people and to see the theater community serve people who wouldn't otherwise have a community of their own.
Because I do think being in shows and theater, I do think it's like, I don't know, it's so good for people.
It's so good for people. It's so good. You know, we're all weird.
Right.
We're all so weird. And you
true.
Get to be weird in theater, and people love you for being weird in theater, which means they just love you for being
which
human.
Which means you're normal.
Which means you're normal. You're human. We're all just so,
or
you know.
While you're in theater.
We all have our own idiosyncrasies, and we all have our, it's a place where you can explore your pain and explore your journey, and it ought to be a safe place. It's not always a safe place, and I think that's what we've all experienced at ACMT also, is that it wasn't always safe. You know,
it wasn't always safe.
It wasn't always safe, and you should be able to explore those things in your life and in your heart and in your psyche and feel safe in doing so.
And I don't remember ever, and I kind of hit this point before, but the idea of being an artist or thinking about your art, like, that feels totally not from that workshop. That feels from other things I've done.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I don't think anyone ever used that word.
He did say things like I had mentioned earlier, he would make the statement that if you have to do this, then you cannot quit. You will have to do this for your life. Like, it is burned into you that you have to do this. And to me, that was part of, at a very deep level, the artistic part of it.
Yeah.
Right? I feel like that was a part of it. And I feel like Annette, I feel like certain people there, Carlos, carried that. But as you said, the walk away from this was to learn how to get a job.
Yeah.
Right. And to be able to leverage them to help you get a job. Like, I remember being really jealous. My coming out of it was, I was this little pretty 18-year-old boy, right? I couldn't get a real job because he had trained me to play Curly in Oklahoma, but I was a 135-pound 18-year-old kid. And so the first, you know, 10 auditions I went on, I couldn't get the male role, right? I kept getting, you know, chorus, and I would be understudy for the lead because they wanted to hire me to do the lead, but I couldn't do the lead on stage, so they'd hire me to be the understudy for the lead, right? And it was painful for me.
And until someone should have told you, you know, these are roles you'll grow into, or to just keep looking at shows and seeing what's out there and just saying yes to things that maybe you weren't familiar with.
The first time, you remember Bill Martell?
No. Do you guys remember Bill Martell?
Bill Martell, the sweetest guy in the world. He was in the workshop after ours.
Okay.
He was my one friend who I lost to the AIDS crisis. Bill Martell and I auditioned for Merrily We Roll Along. And they cast me as Franklin Shepard. Right? But I was 18. I mean, think about what I looked like casting me as Franklin Shepard, right? So we got like two rehearsals in, and they gave it to somebody else. They brought a ringer in to do it. Right?
Where was this at?
Somewhere in Long Beach.
Okay.
And
it's always somewhere in Long Beach. It's always somewhere in Long Beach.
All musical theater roads lead to somewhere.
But it crushed me. And I think that was, you know, one of the times that I was like, I'm not sure I need to do this with my life.
Mm.
Yeah,
if
that's
you're just given it time. If you're just given it time, you would have grown into these. But also, there weren't a lot of opportunities as there were, you know, there were the traditional roles. Now musical theater is just so expansive and so diverse. And,
but also, in the late 80s, musical theater was dead. I mean, if you...
Yeah, it was a dinosaur.
It was just Andrew Lloyd Webber and Hal Prince, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now, it's just...
I'm amazed how we're doing.
Every day, another one opens up. And, but it was... Pickings were slim.
They were... Yeah.
And Sherry, you teach kids, but you also do shows with them.
Yeah.
And does it scratch your musical theater itch to be doing that? Does it feed that same part of your soul that you still love to do them?
It makes me so grateful that I had the experience, and actually the experience I had with the workshop makes me learn. Made me learn how I don't want to be with my kids.
Right.
I want to be encouraging, and if I see someone that has maybe a flaw, I don't want to point at them and point out their flaws. I want to try to encourage them in the areas where they can be better.
So if I was in your show, I wouldn't have to lose 15 pounds?
No,
you
wouldn't.
You wouldn't be saying I'm a little teapot.
That's good, though.
I'm a little sex pot.
You know, I don't think breaking down is a strategy that worked for everybody.
No.
Yeah.
I think it works for some, and like I was saying, with Kristen, maybe it worked because she had the talent in dance. She had the talent. So for other people that maybe weren't quite finished developing their talent, I think it was more reinforced, get over it, you suck. That's kind of how I took it.
Resign yourself to it.
Yeah, you're just not good. And I got very much that vibe from it.
Wow.
Okay, what was everyone's favorite memory of it? Was there one moment, though, that when you're like, I remember this? I'll say what mine is. Carol, you and I did a scene from No Strings where we sang a song about Maine that was kind of goofy. Mm-hmm. And I think we did it once and got feedback that wasn't that great or whatever. I remember us being up there a long time. Do you remember this? And sometimes they would just, the whole class would end up being this one scene, right?
Right.
Hours. Yeah. And then they worked with us and somehow we sort of got out of our own way and did it better and got and they said that was better, and I remember that felt good.
I blocked out a lot of those memories. But I do remember
singing that song.
I remember just having kind of this lightness. It was the first time like, oh, I feel like I'm in it.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to describe it.
I think it was a moment where you feel like you have a little breakthrough. One time whenever you're studying anything. I think that's one thing I remember. Yeah.
I just remember, I don't remember any performance-related moment, right?
Right.
Sorry, Paul, once again, you're proven.
Right.
But I remember just being on the floor with you guys, stretching, doing Alexander techniques, right? I remember just feeling like these are my people.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was a good camaraderie. I remember it was a lot of fun, and because I was there by myself. I didn't know anyone. It was a huge chance. I'd basically been banished by my mother.
Oh, my God. I did not realize that you had put so much on the line.
Yeah, I did, and I didn't have a job. I was delivering sandwiches to day traders to make money. LA Daily, and I had that little thing on wheels.
You brought us sandwiches a couple times.
Yeah, those Gouda sandwiches with sourdough.
Wow.
LA Daily. It was my only social interaction, and I loved it, but I was also so exhausted because I was working, doing that job, and then I would have to prep the sandwiches at night after we would do our rehearsals.
Oh, wow.
And I'd be up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go get the bagels for my route, you know, and go buy things. And so most of my memories are sleeping.
Wow. So you were running this whole side business.
Mama had to make it.
Yeah, I was working at a mall store called the Very, Very Beast, and they sold stuffed animals.
It was the Very, Very Bear. You got me a job there.
No, I did not.
Yes, you did.
I got you a job at the Very, Very Beast?
Yes.
I don't remember that. It was just me and a bunch of Valley Girls. Really, John?
Was it Beast or Bear?
It was a bunch of gun.
A lot of gunned bears.
Yep.
And it was the only job where I... It was West Side Pavilion and also Santa Monica Place. I got you a job there?
Oh, my gosh. I asked you for a job.
I know. I remember it paid, nothing.
Yeah, it was, $7 an hour or something.
Maybe, yeah. Wow.
Hilarious.
That's crazy. Wow. Kristen, what do you have a favorite memory of the workshop?
You know, I was a baby.
I was such a baby, and I don't have a specific memory. I remember that time in my life of just being affirmation that, yes, I can do this. And, you know, I mean, I was barely 18 years old. I was still living with my mom and dad, and I had, you know, 1.5 feet out the door. I knew I was going to go to New York. I knew what my career was going to be, and it was an affirmation for me. Maybe I was young and foolish. I don't know, but it happened, so I guess I wasn't that foolish. But it was being surrounded, even though the exercises, the time during instruction might not have felt safe, it felt like a very safe place to me because of the community, because of the people. And I loved
that. We were all in it.
And it was intense. It was like 30 hours a week.
Yes, and I remember
thinking, it was like a full-time job.
If this is what it is, and I'm surviving this, I can do this.
That's wild. That's good.
Did anybody else spend their whole days thinking about getting there, though?
No, it was all like, I have to leave here. I got to go on the 10. And it was
the freeway.
Yeah,
there was no always, easy way to get there.
Yeah, it was always a nightmare. But I do remember coming out at night, downtown L.A., and it looked like L.A. Law. It was a big city, and I was like, wow, I'm down here. I'm doing this thing.
You can take the boy out of Holbrook.
I kind of can't believe I had the courage to do it in a way.
You guys go to the Walt Disney Concert Hall and see it there and go, that was the parking lot I used to park every night.
Oh, right. Yes. I forgot
that. Kind of trips me out.
I do think of the Dorothy Chandler. Whenever I go down there, I do remember it. Yeah. Dennis, what's the thing that came out of it for you?
Well, it actually changed my whole life. I mean, because that's... I met Frank Baer there.
Bye, right. Bye.
And
bye.
Through Frank, he asked me, he had told me that that LA Classic Theater Works was doing a radio broadcast of Once in a Lifetime, and Tom Moore was directing it, needed an assistant. So I was his assistant, and it was these all-star cast of people that I was in charge of for a couple weeks. And through there, I met a friend who was close with Steve Sondheim.
Right.
And told Steve about this young writer that he knew about in L.A. that, you know, that he should know. And I got a letter from Steve one day saying, you know, we're starting this Young Playwrights Festival, you know, for people that want to write. And, you know, if you're interested in that, you know, you should know about it. And we started a correspondence, and he became my mentor and my father figure for all these years later.
That's amazing. Did you guys all know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah, so he's... So that changed my life, and it was because of Steve, and they were also, you know, in the middle of Into the Woods at that time, and so he brought me into that whole world, and where I just learned about theater and learned about writing, and
were you in New York when they were doing Into the Woods on Broadway?
Yeah, when it was just
with
coming
Joanna,
out,
right?
Oh yeah, Joanna, and I became part of that whole thing. I was there all the time, and whenever he had to be there, he said, come and, you know, watch this. And then, like, if somebody was leaving the show, he'd always invite me to the dinner, you know, say goodbye to them. And so he just brought me in, but not only Into the Woods, but just in his whole world of people. So I it was my college, basically, that I never got.
And that's incredible.
That's how I became.
That's Buster, everyone.
That's Buster. He's not a big Sondheim fan.
Can you first cast?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a... Yeah, so that... So my whole... I mean, because of that musical theater workshop...
The connection.
I became a writer, which I wanted to be. And that's what gave me my life that I have now.
Wow. That workshop did.
That workshop, yeah.
Wow. That's
meeting wild. Frank in that
really
workshop.
Is.
So, and Frank and I became close because of the Paul incident, so...
What was the Paul incident?
Incident?
The Paul incident.
Should this go on a podcast?
I don't know, it shouldn't go on a podcast.
He was very cruel to me after that. You know, humiliating me a lot and putting me in, you know, linking me with people that he knew I wouldn't work well with and not with people I really wanted to be with. So, towards the end, I talked to Frank Baer about it and about what had happened. And Frank was mortified, but because of that, Frank and I became friends.
You could see somebody was playing favorites, and then you were kind of glad it wasn't you in a way, even though you didn't quite know everything.
You escaped.
It tainted the whole experience.
Of course.
Like when you had said, "What good memories do you have in that workshop?" I have none.
I agree with you. I was thinking the same thing.
You don't have any.
Except for you guys.
I have no good memories because of that. I look at that as a black. time and a frustrating time.
And Cher, you felt the same way. Like,
I probably would have done better if I didn't take it.
You think you would have done better?
I was going.
That's
right. I was actually in college studying musical theater, and my voice teacher at the college was in the opera workshop, and he knew Paul Gleason.
Right.
And he didn't want me to take it. He goes, "Don't take it."
Really?
And he actually told me, "He goes, he will destroy you." He goes, "You're not." He goes, "You're not ready." He says, "You need about 2 years still." And I thought I was being badass, and I ignored him and dropped out of college, and I went and did it. And I look back, and probably he was right.
Interesting.
Because I was feeling, I was getting parts, I was feeling confident, I was studying voice and dance, and I was trying to build myself, and he just pretty much, "You suck." And I probably stuck with me. So for me, it was a destroyer. I'm like you. Except for you guys.
Careful about who you entrust your talent to and who you allow into your space to teach you and to help develop your work, because there are people that try to play psychologists that have no business digging around in your stuff.
Right.
And there are things that do get in the way of your work. So much of it is your mindset and your psychology, but then there are just some people that are just working out
that sort of
no
tough
business.
Love. I'm going to do this for your own good, and you'll thank me later.
And, you know, as I was saying before, he's from that generation of people.
I feel like that's
did.
Not the way people think now.
No,
I think
right.
that was a generational
right.
thing.
There are. Well, I just find
out. I would, they really thought that way then. You know, he was a rat in Cinderella. You know?
I had a ballet teacher who was like this, you know, and when I was going to school at the time, who would pull
ballet,
me aside.
Ballet
and,
teachers are totally different.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking of, I guess, Fosse, and that's, those are the artists from that generation that
oh,
I think
Fosse
of.
Would never treat people
no,
like that.
No.
You don't think so?
No.
Well, you would know better than I.
No.
What song, when you hear it, do you think of the workshop?
Rhythm of Life.
Rhythm of Life, because we did that in the finale.
Yeah. Master of the House.
Master of the House.
Master of the House, right when Les Mis came out.
Yes.
We all thought we
it
were so cutting
there.
Edge.
Because I actually
well, we were,
later.
Weren't we?
Yeah. Yeah. We were very cutting edge.
It was
in
so
London
narcissistic. All I think about is my audition songs.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That I, that, so, My Funny Valentine, A Woman in Love.
I sang this song called, and the reason we don't want to watch the videotape of our final show.
Is there videotape?
Yes.
Well, I don't have it.
Make
there is.
I have it. Make no mistake, we want to watch the videotape.
But I sang this song called Sometimes a Day Goes By. I don't remember what it was from.
Oh, it was it's Sondheim.
Is
sometimes
it?
A day
sometimes
goes by.
A day goes
it's from Marilyn Monroe.
No, that's not
a day
goes
by.
I don't think it's Sondheim.
Yeah, it
but anyway, at the very end of the song, it goes, till morning comes, and then there she is again, right? So I made this choice that I'm going to see her in the room and say, there she is again. And it's so big and embarrassing. It's like maybe my most embarrassing moment in my life. Like, oh, there, like she burst in,
there
like,
she is.
Like, hey, Kool-Aid just came into the room.
And I have,
now you all remember it. You all remember it.
I have rewound that moment. And had such
no.
a much of it. Yes.
Did you have friends over and say, you've got to see this guy do this thing?
That has,
I
that
brought
has,
it with me to New York and I played it.
Oh, my God.
Dennis, we should post it on YouTube.
Yeah, that would be really,
yes.
that would be really fun
yes.
thing
yes.
to do.
No, but I'll never
someone,
forget that.
Do you remember that?
Remember. No, they videotaped the last
final
presentation.
Yeah.
Did we do auditions?
I think we all sang a song.
We all sang a
song. I don't remember having a solo.
I think I sang I'm Not At All In Love.
Wow. That's a lot of stuff.
That's a lot.
Do you guys still love to go to musicals?
Yes.
Yes.
I do, and I will try for no reason.
I just saw Guys and Dolls at the Globe. And there were two African-American men in the leads playing Skye and Nathan. And
oh
I was
my gosh.
Fabulous.
Peeing myself.
Did you know going in? Or was you got there and you're
like,
oh,
I got there and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
We haven't seen each other since we were in our late teens, early 20s.
That's right.
We're now
except
all
for Dennis and I have seen
we're
each other.
Now all around 50.
Right.
So, dream role.
I don't think of myself that much of an actor. So let
no,
me
but
think.
Still, yeah. a musical theater
I,
dream
yeah.
role. So I'll tell you right now for me, it's easy.
Curly?
Marius? Jean Valjean.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Les Mis.
You would
yeah.
be great.
All right. That's a good question.
That's a great question. I have to think about that for a minute.
Pippin was one of my favorite shows ever.
You would have been a great Pippin.
So I like that music a lot, but I don't know.
You did Corner of the Sky in the workshop, didn't you?
I might have. I'm sure I made some weird choices that alienated people. And
I think you pointed at that Corner of the Sky.
I did. I was like, I went like this with my hand. You know.
Got a fire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I would say eponine and alphabet.
Eponine and alphabet.
Eponine and alphabet.
Yeah, the E's. That's good.
E's.
What about you, Carol?
Character in Game of Thrones.
Oh.
That's like good. A Cersei.
Kill yeah. Cersei. Yeah.
But I had 2 years of like dream role, so and I'm going to do Desiree and Little Night Music next.
Oh, that's amazing!
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
but wow. My dream role was Caroline and Caroliner Change, and I did it.
Mm. Oh, where did
no
you
idea.
Do it?
PCPA.
How was it?
It was amazing.
That's
it was the
awesome.
Best experience.
Oh, I love it.
I worked my ass off on it. I worked on that music for like 5 years yeah. before I went and did it.
I think you more than any of us have stayed in the musical theater world. Yes.
Going back to your earlier story about not going to college and coming out and doing that, what did your parents ever come around?
Yeah, well, it was a couple of things. I wrote this musical.
That's awesome.
Called The Princess and the Black Eyed Pea, and I won a Richard Rodgers Award and got a John Larson grant.
That's amazing.
Let's all enjoy that for a minute.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to see that show.
And that intrigued my parents because
right.
that was something
the
tangible.
Part.
They understood that. They didn't understand performing.
Right.
And then I went to grad school because I went back to school because it always bothered me that I never got my degree. So
right.
I found this program at Cal State Long Beach and I got my master's in teaching theater, teaching acting and directing. So that part of my life I was able to finish up and go, okay,
right.
good. I did it. And they stopped bothering me. So, but this is this was just
the
in the past 10 years.
Yeah.
So they never really
I
came
love
around.
That they understood writing, but they didn't understand performance.
Most parents don't understand theater.
I don't know.
Don't
well, my dad's a writer and a teacher,
oh, okay.
and he was the one that really taught me the value of education, and he was always big on reading and writing and self-expression and he probably wanted me to go into teaching because that's what he did. He did counseling and teaching. And my mother was a homemaker, and she only finished the 7th grade. And my father had like 3 college degrees. So so it was a big thing for me not to finish school because at least... And they didn't know anything about the arts. You know, few people do.
Yeah, no, it's...
And they only understand, you know, things that are kind of consistent in 9-to-5 jobs.
Yeah, feel like I've seen you in commercials.
Yeah.
What was the most successful commercial you did?
Years ago. I was with KSR, Joseph Helfand and Ricks.
Yeah.
I was with them for like 20 years.
Oh, mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of commercials with them. So,
right on.
So they ran for like years at a time. And then, but they didn't like me doing theater, and I always had to go and do another show. And they're like, you're not making us any money while you're on
right.
theater. And I'm having the same argument with my managers now, but I can't say no to theater. It's like I have to, you know. So when you were talking about Paul saying it has to be in you... Mm-hmm. It was like, yeah, okay, I just realized I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. I have, no matter what I'm doing, and I've eaten instant potato flakes and slept on friends' floors and slept in my car, you know, right after the workshop. I was basically homeless after the workshop again.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What else about the workshop? Any other closing thoughts?
There was a game where we all had to sit in a circle,
okay.
and we were asked by Paul to name... an actor or actress in the industry, film, soaps, whatever, that we would not want to be. Like, who do we despise? And everybody went around, and they were saying, oh, I wouldn't want to be this person, or I wouldn't want to be Suzanne Summers, or whatever. And I was thinking, there is nobody... There's nobody that I don't want to be. If I know who they are, they're more famous than me. So I just looked at him and said, there's no one. And he looked at me like he wanted to kill me. And then he kept going around the circle, and everybody said the people they didn't want to be. And then he stood up and said, you're all a bunch of fucking assholes. Because every single person you named is known, and you were nobody. And I'm like, I passed that test.
You nailed it. You called me. Yeah.
Yeah.
You pissed him off because you ruined his little reverse...
His little mind fuck.
You could feel like he was a little jealous of certain people or whatever.
But that's what's so funny, what a hypocrite he is. You know, it's so typical.
I am pleased that I don't think I was in a lot of... I don't have a lot of painful memories of it. I remember thinking it was screwed up, but I think I kind of got through it unscathed.
But Dennis, that's who you are, though. You that's why you are adorable. That's why everybody loves you so much. Because
hang on a second, I'm putting the thing closer to you.
No, I'm serious. Because you always believe in the positive, and the you know you always look at for the best and the brightest.
Right.
That's the way you are. It's just your nature.
Right.
You've always been that way.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I look back on it, and I was like, it was a good thing for my life, and I knew that there was a lot of fucked upness around it, but I don't feel like I have those scars that much.
I don't feel
somehow.
Scarred from it.
Yeah,
I don't feel scarred from it.
No, and I don't either.
Right,
at all. Like you know, I was telling Carol,
When she said, "Oh, you should write about them," I said, "Who would care? It doesn't mean make any difference."
Right.
I have no scarring, but all right. I do think is the life I live now was rooted right there.
Does
it seem like all that time?
Yes.
Yes.
It does.
Yes.
There's a lot of life that's happened between then and now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank God.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like that long sitting here.
30 years.
I mean, it's
30 years.
30 years. Let's all just soak that in for a minute.
That's a long time.
But at the same time, I don't feel awkward in any of this conversation. I feel like we just picked up.
Right. There's still a connection.
Here's kind of a heady question that we can cut out if people aren't into it. But if you could go back and tell yourself in the workshop one thing.
Oh, God.
What would you say?
You have an awesome husband coming down the line. Just wait.
Yeah, you have an awesome husband coming down the line. I love that.
Life is going to be this good. Yeah.
I would say to myself, you know what? Shoot for 12 pounds. Just shoot for 12. Anything else? No, I don't know.
Don't be so hard on yourself.
I think so. Maybe a little of that.
Be kinder to yourself. Mm. And don't let other people's bullshit, don't take it on. You don't have to own any of that.
You don't have to own other people's bullshit.
Yeah, and recognize it when it's coming from someone who's just shitting. You know, trust your instincts.
Yeah.
I think I would tell myself, you don't have a breathing problem. You're fine.
You don't have a breathing problem. You're fine. That's a good one.
Drinking?
Yeah.
I think I would tell myself that there's more kindness in the world than what you're experiencing now.
Wow.
Bravo.
And in the industry.
And in the industry.
Yeah. In the industry, absolutely.
It's not terrifying.
And I would encourage myself, my younger self. I almost said my young self as if I'm ancient. Can we all agree that we're not ancient?
We're not ancient.
I would encourage my younger self to really seek to be intentional about being part of that kindness sooner. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe we can model that for younger people. Because when you're in your 19s and 20s like we didn't have that presence of mind.
We didn't.
And probably our parents didn't either, you know, when going into... I know mine certainly didn't.
Right.
But, you know, the fact that we did it and challenged ourselves and acted in spite of our fear and acted in spite of any self-imposed or other imposed...
Yeah, because when we went there, it was like... The
it's an act of trust.
The deal was these people know. They have the answers.
They gave them too much power.
Yeah, they had a they had a lot of power.
Yes.
Like, I don't remember anyone ever standing
they
up.
They did.
Yeah.
And we also gave it to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't Google them before we auditioned.
No.
Yeah,
so we couldn't Yelp them. We couldn't Google them. We couldn't
different
find
world.
Out what was going on there.
We was living in the dark ages, y'all.
Yeah. All right. It's so great to see you guys again. I'm so glad we did this.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right. Thanks for being on the
make
podcast.
Sure you edit, Boo.
I will.
Thanks again to Dennis Osborne, Carol Foreman, John Thomas, Kristen Dahl, and Sherry Fleming for sharing their memories and getting together. And thank you guys for letting us do something different. I hope you enjoyed it. All right, so this happened. So get this. I saw Paul Gleason, the man we were all talking about, at an event a few years ago, sometime between the workshop mini reunion from 2017 and today. It would have been before the pandemic. It was his ex-wife, Joanna Gleason, was performing a show at The Village where we do the mismatch game at the Renberg Theater. And there was a reception afterwards, and I saw Paul there, and I didn't have the nerve to say anything. I should have. I really regret that. Just to see if he would have remembered me or what he had to say about anything, I should have done it. I don't know why I didn't do it. I think I would have... The me of today would have done it, but there was something back then, a few years ago, that held me back. Anyway, that happened. He looked like himself, much older. You know, it's been a long time. But I didn't say anything, and I wish I would have. Just to see if he remembered me at all, if he remembered our class, our group, you know. Maybe he would have told me I still need to lose 10 pounds. Maybe that was my holdup. Yeah, that was probably it. And it might have been 15. I can't remember the exact number. So that happened. And I also want to share something that is happening. April is going to be the 10th anniversary of the Dennis Anyone podcast. I can't believe it. It's been 10 years since I started this thing, and I've really come to love it more and more each passing day. So I think I want to do something special for my 10th anniversary
episode, I'm going to give you guys the voicemail number. And if you have anything you want to share for my 10th anniversary episode, if you were a guest on the podcast and you want to say something, or you remember, you know, something that you heard that made you smile, or something, just maybe how it saved your life and changed everything overnight for you, you can say that. Just anything you want to say, any musings, here is that number. It's 1-888-647-9653. 1-888-647-9653. It's a voicemail. Leave a little anniversary wish, 10 years on there, and I'll put together, I'll put them together. I'm going to see. Maybe no one will submit, and it'll be one of those things where we do the episode, and somebody will be like, wait, weren't there supposed to be voicemail messages? I know I have enough sure things that will do it if I prompt them. But I would love to have some surprises in there. People that I don't have to call up and say, hey, will you call my voicemail and say happy anniversary to Dennis, anyone? Anyway, that's the deal. It's coming up. I can't believe it. And I'm really gratified that I'm still here doing it, and it's come to mean more to me than I ever imagined. So that's because of you. Thank you so much. All right, that's enough for this week. I want to give a shout out to Oscar Rosario for mixing the episodes. My theme music is by Mark Danos for Placement Music. We'll catch you next time on Dennis Anyone.
Bye.